Welcome back to season two of the podcast, where we're having candid conversations, open, honest, vulnerable conversations from people, friends, and clients that I admire. Our intention here is to educate and empower you. We are unscripted, we are live, and today we are diving in with a community member, Paige Sparks, I almost said, I'm so sorry, Paige Sparks, and her friend and colleague Madison as well. Welcome both of you.
Thank you for having us on your podcast. This is awesome.
You're welcome. Oh my gosh. So, okay. I'm stoked. I think we're all a little nervous right now because this is like a super last minute thing that I asked Paige to come onto the podcast. We've been talking about this conversation. I've been sober from alcohol for 5 years now, and Paige really resonated with some of the things that I have shared. And we got into a conversation a while ago about how there are options for addiction recovery that are outside of AA and that aren't just all or nothing. And that just completely blows my mind because I had never heard about that. I still haven't, like, I haven't done the research or dove in any deeper. That is why I've invited you both here, because I just want to talk about it. And I definitely want to put out there that this is unknown territory for me. And I'm just really grateful that you are both here and setting this safe space and the stage to just kind of talk. And why don't you both take a moment to introduce yourselves?
Okay. Maddie, do you want to go first?
Sure. So my name is Madison, but I go by Maddie. I am a PsyD student. I'm working on my doctorate in clinical psychology with an emphasis in forensics. So currently I am employed by the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation at Richard J. Donovan State Prison, where I provide therapy to incarcerated adults. Almost all of my caseload and my patients have substance use diagnoses, and some of them are still actively using. I've had experience working with substance use for a couple years now, both inside and out of prison. And while I have been working at this prison, I got certified in SMART recovery, which is a tool that not a lot of people know about. So, Courtney, you're not alone in this idea that there's something other than AA out there. And so I was certified in this SMART recovery specifically for forensic populations and those who are incarcerated. But it is another tool for achieving sobriety and long-term recovery.
Awesome.
Everything about me.
Thank you.
Awesome. Okay. So I'm Paige, Paige Sparks. I'm also a PsyD clinical doctoral student. I'm also, Maddie and I go to the same school. And so this is just an awesome opportunity for us to share our knowledge while we're in the process of learning it. I also have a forensic emphasis. A cool thing about Maddie and I is we actually went to the same outplacement/practicum site. I was at Sharper Future in my second year, and Maddie was there for her third year. And right now I'm doing my pre-doctoral internship, so fancy, out in Trenton, at Trenton Psychiatric Hospital in New Jersey. So it's nice and cold over here, which is great. And while substance use wasn't something that I thought I was going to be doing, just because I'm in the forensic field, it tends to be kind of a thing. And so while I don't have the clinical training and certification that Maddie has in SMART recovery, I do have a lot of experience doing different kinds of substance manualized treatment and or just like substance treatment in general, a lot of behavioral techniques and therapies. And one of the things that I love the most is trying to bring some just authentic humor into the therapeutic practice, especially just because when it comes to substance use, when it comes to the forensic population, it's very cut and dry, very like, okay, you know, this is what we're doing, this is how we're going to do it. And I think that that can be really dry for people. So I try to bring the humanity back into the therapy room for people. So that's where I'm at. That's
my It's also important to know that since both Paige and I work in like forensic settings, so psychiatric hospital or prisons, that the comorbidity rate of dual diagnosis with someone who has mental illness and substance use, I think it's like above 86% or something like that. It is incredibly high.
Oh, wow.
You cannot work in one of these kinds of settings and not encounter substance use. It's impossible. for the most part, because the common denominator with all of these folks is that a lot of people have experienced trauma in their past. And so that's where we see a lot of the origination of these kinds of diagnoses.
Thank you for sharing that. That sounds like a really, really important piece. And I love that. That's something that I definitely appreciate about Paige, and I'm sure you too, Maddie, as I'm getting to know you, is just like the well-rounded approach I feel that you both hold for addiction recovery that is outside of this like all or nothing mainstream type way of looking at it.
Mm-hmm. Granted, AA has been around a lot longer than Smart Recovery. Smart Recovery was only created within the last maybe 15 years by Dr. Horvath, who actually came to our class one day. We had a substance abuse class over the summer, and he came with us. So yeah, there we go. That's him right there. That's his book.
So I'm holding up a book for those who are not going to see what we're doing. So there's a book by Dr. Horvath called Sex, Drugs, Gambling, and Chocolate. And it's a really, really wonderful guide on addiction just in general, not just substance addiction, not just X, Y, and Z. It's a lot more broad than people want to talk about. We think addiction, we think substance. We don't think of food. We don't think of sex. We don't think of technology. I think technology is a big one, relationships as well. So there's a lot that goes into the topic of addiction. Substance is just the very beginning of it. And something that I thought was really poignant that you just said, Courtney, was how things are well-rounded. I wanted to bring up this word that I think gets overlooked, which is intersectionality. When we do therapy and when we do, anything involving helping another person, we have to look at it from an intersectional position. So that way we can see like, okay, it's not just like, oh, this person is feeling some sort of way and now they're engaging in substance use. It's also like, what happened in their background? You know, what are they missing in their life? Have they been through trauma? Because trauma is a big indicator and risk factor, quote unquote, for substance use. And so people forget these things and they gloss over it and they're just like, oh, that person's an addict.
Yeah. So we'll get into that for sure. Paige and I are both like CBT therapists. That's how we like conceptualize our patients. And so the model we use is like a biopsychosocial, meaning like your biology, your psychology, and your like sociology impacts the individual. And so there's, yes, we want to look at trauma in the past. We want to look at what are some maybe psychological vulnerabilities that someone has to maybe use substances, but then we also have to look at society, because a lot of research is showing that society has a big impact on those who engage in substance use as well. I think we'll probably get to that a little bit later, but that's why we look at this whole holistic image of a person, because it's not just one thing. It's not like this occurs in a vacuum. Someone doesn't just decide to become an alcoholic one day. There's a whole chain of things that lead up to this addiction.
Yeah. Thank you for mentioning that. And I just want to be completely candid. Last year, when I took my first 20-hour trauma-informed yoga training, that was the first time that I'd really ever heard about these intersections. And it like completely blew my mind and really cracked me open to realizing, you know, diving into privilege and race and all of that kind of stuff. So do you mind, when I hear you talking about like kind of speaking to intersectionality, what I'm hearing is a lot of like holistic stuff. And I'm kind of, can you kind of take apart for me what the difference between this being a holistic approach and what the intersectionality actually is?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So when I say holistic, I mean like the whole image of someone. There's also like holistic medicine, which is somewhat similar in that it's about the whole individual. And intersection means there's so many different pieces to us as people. It goes back to our gender, our race, our culture, our upbringing, where we grew up, geography, the resources that we had access to, so our socioeconomic status, your sexual orientation. It's literally every single piece of an individual that makes them who they are. And there's a lot of pieces. And we can't just look at someone and be like, oh, you have this problem. And it's like, no, what does your culture say about this? What about the gender impacts? And I specialize in working with those in the LGBTQ plus community. So that is also a big piece. I make sure to never forget someone's gender or sexual expression, because that's really important to understanding an individual.
Oh, that was Absolutely. Yeah, that was seriously like, whoo, that was a good, great one. Do you have anything to add, Paige? Or?
Yeah, I mean, piggybacking off of what Maddie's talking about, Maddie's very eloquent in the way that she explains things, and so it makes it hard for me to share.
No, but bring in the genuineness, because sometimes I can
wrote. Oh, for sure. But I think when it comes to intersectionality, we have to, yes, look at the person, look at where they're coming from, and be able to help the person not only see what they're currently going through, but help them expand into those areas. Because I think when we think about an individual person, like if I'm thinking about myself, I'm going to wear those rose-colored glasses for myself when looking at myself. I'm too close to the situation to see what's going on around me necessarily. And so within, you know, addressing these kinds of problems when we're, whether it's substance related or just addiction in general, I think it's really important to help the person see not only what are all these other facets of what makes them who they are, but how do we connect them to those things so that way they can actually pull on the things that they've experienced, be able to rely on their own identity. I think identity formation is something that gets lost in translation. I think a lot of people who are in therapy, who are finding that it's not helpful for them, or finding that they're struggling with it, there are things that are not quite connected quite yet for them. And so something I try to do with my patients is start with baby steps. A lot of people forget that within this work, within being intersectional and being mindful of all these things that make us who we are, we gloss over these little details and we're just like, I want to get to this big thing and I want to fix it. That doesn't always work. we have to be able to take these little teeny minute steps forward. And sometimes it's a tiny aha moment where it's like, oh, I recognize that I'm feeling X, Y, and Z way. Like I'm depressed. And so I'm eating my feelings, right? That's an easy one that people can relate with, which is like, oh, I'm sad. I'm feeling some sort of way. So I'm going to eat. When in reality, there's so much more that goes into that. And if we can find a way to connect those dots for people and help them to see who they are in a much bigger way within the world, rather than crushing them down into this tiny little insignificant piece of sand in the wind, like generally speaking, you'll be a lot more successful if you can find your spot and you can take up your own space. So intersectionality is really important, not only within the person and within their environment, but helping them to make those connections for themselves.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you. What I hear you speaking to is kind of what I refer to often as like stupid simple, like the baby steps thing, you know, it's like simplicity. Yes. And I do that with my clients constantly, just taking it back to, and it feels so stupid simple. It's just like, yeah, it really is. It's those tiny little steps that add up to like this greater awareness for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Well, think about most people who are suffering with addiction, not very many people are successful at just going cold turkey and just one and done and like that's it. A lot of people need time to kind of look at themselves and start making long-term and short-term goals. We don't ever want to look at something, because looking at recovery, it's a very daunting thing, this huge idea of recovery. And so that's why we break things into smaller pieces, these baby steps, so that way you're helping yourself achieve little baby steps, you're starting to grow some confidence in yourself, and then ultimately you get there. It's not like, again, there are some people, and I do know some people who have been sober for, you know, 10 plus years, and it was just because one day they decided to stop, but that does not represent everyone. A lot of us need that little help, someone to kind of motivate us, and that's kind of our job in doing therapy with these folks, is helping them with the little tiny baby steps and saying, whoa, don't look at this big overwhelming thing. Like, just look at this little tiny thing, maybe just using a little bit less today. And that can be really helpful for the people that we work with.
Yeah, yeah. I think it could be even really helpful for a lot of people. I feel like there's a big, I don't know, I like to say waves of awakening or just like consciousness, where I know a lot of people are choosing, especially with alcohol specifically, that they don't want to drink anymore and that they want to be more conscious in their consuming. And kind of what I hear you almost explaining in the long-term recovery option and like being with yourself more in it is that you can learn acceptance more. Whereas like cold turkey, I feel like you always look back at that part of your life with like despise and upsetness, and it keeps you separate from yourself.
It absolutely makes a lot of shame and guilt, because that's the whole idea of this all or nothing with the AA model of sobriety, is that if you backtrack or backslide, however insignificant, it's like you have to start over. You completely failed. And think about how that impacts your self-esteem and self-confidence in this process. And that is why SORT recovery is completely different. You don't have to be completely abstinent. They understand, as part of the model, that people are going to relapse, and that's the stages of change. And the Smart Recovery's model has a relapse portion, because we understand that it's not always a one and done kind of thing, and we also understand we're people, and we have to be self-compassionate towards ourselves in any sort of change. I mean, think about just simple things you try to change daily, like I want to make sure I clean my house all the time, or like at least once a week. Like, just simple things like that is even really hard. Yes. So that's why this self-compassion piece is so important in this process. I never want to shame someone for backsliding or relapsing, because it is a part of the process.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And I think something else, to piggyback off of Maddie again, I think something that's very common within these AA and NA models, where it's a 12-step recovery program, there's a lot of what within the therapy world we call external locus of control, which is, I'm not the one in control. There's a higher power, or there's other people, or there's other social expectations of me that control my behavior. Mm-hmm. And while in some cases that may be true, like there may be certain mandates, like you can't do this past certain time of day, whatever, like depending on where you are and where you live. I know in Pennsylvania, like, we live in a very interesting state. Like, you can only go and, like, get certain things from certain stores because they want to limit what you can buy. Whatever, that's fine. But that's an external locus of control example. Whereas with internal locus of control, which is more the SMART recovery model, is I'm the one with control. I'm the one making my own decisions. And I'm the one that ultimately has to make, you know, the right changes in my life to be successful. And I think what's beautiful about, I mean, we'll start with SMART recovery. What I think is beautiful about the way that SMART recovery focuses, the way they help people, is they don't do it in a linear way. I think a lot of people think, okay, I'm going to go from having an addiction to being sober, and I'm going to be able to just pass through a program and I'm going to be fine. When in reality, that's not the case. We go through a lot of different things in our lives. Our lives are more like tangled knots than anything else. And we have to be patient with that process. And the fact that SMART recovery includes that relapse portion, where it's like, this is a normal thing. The biggest thing that they focus on is harm reduction, which I think a lot of people don't think of, which is, okay, I want to, for example, if I was having an issue with drinking, at some point, my ultimate goal may be to stop drinking entirely. That's fine. That's totally fine. Anybody can have that goal. To stop cold turkey may not work for me. It might work for somebody else, and that's fine. Right. But if I'm beating myself over the head thinking, okay, I have to stop, and if I take any sip of alcohol, I'm giving up. That all or nothing thinking destroys everything that I've worked on. When in reality, if I think of it in a way of like, okay, I drank less today. Great. I feel better. Okay. Now I can sit with those feelings of, okay, it's not perfect, but I recognize that overall my feeling in my body is that I feel better. I'm sleeping better. I'm feeling better. I don't have headaches, X, Y, and Z. Like, there's so many things that go along with different kinds of substances. And if people can sit with this feeling and ride those waves of, you know, oh, I'm having a craving or an urge. And then, you know, maybe they do end up like taking a sip of alcohol or using or whatever it may be. But then they recognize and they have a thought afterward, which is, this really isn't doing it for me. That's still harm reduction. Like, that's still part of that process.
Oh my gosh. I have so many thoughts. I love this. Part of what I'm hearing you say is, let me see, I took a note here. It's that what you're describing is like this awareness that is, like, I keep referring to this awareness that comes with being more present in your recovery. And that also brings you back to your body. You're talking about mm-hmm. knowing how you're feeling and what your energy levels are like and all this stuff. And that awareness of, like, connecting with your body again is how we heal trauma. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to know anything about that. That's just, like, my one of my big mind blow things right now.
Yeah. So totally. A lot of our techniques are, we have my favorite one. We use Therapist Aid a whole lot because it's a really great resource. And it's like,
it's free.
And there's like a person, and it's like, where do you feel things in your body? And you'll color and draw where you feel things, because I think a lot of people are not practicing a whole lot of mindfulness. Mindfulness is being in the present moment and knowing your surroundings and feeling what your body is feeling. And I think a lot of times we overlook how our body is feeling, and we'll write it off as something else, or we'll rationalize what we're thinking, or we just completely blow it off. And so part of this whole process is to become self-aware, to be more mindful of your own body and what's happening. Because sometimes your body can be feeling something and you haven't quite labeled what you're feeling just yet. If you know that anxiety makes your stomach hurt because it affects your gastrointestinal system, and that you feel like your heart rate is increasing and you feel like your blood pressure is pretty high, I can take a moment and say, what am I feeling right now? And kind of do a self-evaluation. This is helpful for everyone, not just in recovery. A lot of us don't do this on a daily basis. And that's why those that practice, you know, mindfulness meditation and yoga and these things where you have to be really in tune with your body, they're more likely to be able to identify what's going on with them when something is wrong, because you're very attuned to yourself.
Right. And especially with what you're speaking to, Paige, with the external focus of control versus the internal, and how the external kind of just says, basically, in AA specifically, I think they speak to God.
Yes. And
like a higher power outside of you, whatever that may be. And that just has never resonated with me. But I realized that I've taken this approach of the internal focus, like in my own life, from what I just heard you describe. And I'm realizing that I have found a source that I believe in that is bigger than me, without a doubt, through going through myself. And that just also blows my mind, because I'm like, I honestly never thought that I would be where I'm at. Maybe you know some of my story, or people that are listening might, but I totally just lost my train of thought. That's fine. It'll come back.
Well, I will help you out here. So I think it's important to know that we are not haters of AA or NA models. We just know that it does not work for everyone, this higher power thing. What about people that are not religious or do not have a really close connection with whoever they believe in? And so it works, and it has worked for a lot of people, but for a lot of other people, it truly doesn't. That's a hard thing to give into if you don't truly like believe it at your core. And so what do you do with all these people that it doesn't work for? Oh, well, you're just out of luck.
I'm just realizing too, like, how traumatic religion is in and of itself for many people. Like,
yeah,
I mean, it's very shameful and things like that. Like it breeds that kind of, those kind of emotions at times. And so, yeah, this is just, wow.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's important, like, when we think about just the human experience, there's a lot of social stipulations that we're expected to adhere to, whether it's the, like, biological social clock, where it's like, okay, at X, Y, and Z age, I got to get through school, I got to get a job, I got to get, you know, married and have a family and do all of this. And it's just like, these kinds of social pressures. And then on top of that, you have culture. And like, depending on your family background, there's extra things that you might be, you know, pressured to do, and, you know, different, you know, roles you might be expected to fulfill. And, you know, depending on your own personal history in school with your, I mean, just there's so much that goes into who we are as individual people. Like, there's three people in this conversation that are so drastically different as people, but we can all connect on this, like, human level of we're people, we've been through some stuff, you know, and like, we're still here having these conversations because we see the importance in doing so. Because if we can have this conversation, somebody else might not be quite there, but if they can hear other people having this conversation, it might help them. Mm-hmm. And I just, harm reduction. I just have to like nail that into the ground really quick because it's so important to like give yourself a break. Like I think people are constantly, especially here in the States, maybe in other countries as well, but there's this really intense expectation to like go, 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 drive, 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 like continue, like get your work done and, you know, be a cog in the machine. And I don't know about you guys, but I don't like that. I try to like push people, especially my patients. Like I work in a locked inpatient facility with people that are going to be there for a long time because for whatever reason, they're experiencing a lot of, you know, mental instability and a lot of other things along with that. And they have this kind of like experience of, I don't have control. And so just finding little bits and pieces, you know, you may not be in a locked facility, but like in your own life, what do you have control over when you're feeling mm-hmm. like spiraling and things are just really intense? And all of a sudden your brain is like, I want the easy solution right now, which is, you know, let me take a puff of a cigarette or let me take a drink or, you know, I'm going to, you know, do X, Y, and Z. Hey, you know what? At the end of the day, you're going to do what feels best in that moment. Our whole emphasis is to listen to what you're feeling. And if that's something that you're actively trying to change, give yourself a moment. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to recognize, like, we ride these waves, like common one for me, I will use myself as an example. Like I get super stressed. Like I'm just hot mess express on a regular basis. And oh, God, I shared this with my patients. I just, you know, it's a thing. And so I'm just, you know, in those moments when I'm really stressed, I try to take stock of what I'm feeling. Like, okay, I'm breathing too fast. I'm not getting enough oxygen. I'm pacing. I'm bouncing my leg. My tongue is touching the top of my mouth, which is a sign of stress. I'm clenching my jaw. My face is hot, whatever's going on. And I always, 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 for me, check if I'm hungry because that's an indication that I'm stressed.
The moment I'm like,
I get hangry and I'm like, oh, maybe I need to just chill the fuck out for a second. Mm-hmm. And, you know, give myself a moment and take a sip of water and maybe go outside and get some sunlight because I'm a hermit.
Well, I'm glad you brought up.
We forget to do.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought up the idea of taking control because we work with people who feel like they have no control. And you can relate this topic to anything. I like it most with anger management. Like, you cannot control what other people are going to do or society is going to do. This whole pandemic is pretty much proof. Like, we have no control over what is happening, but I can take it upon myself and control whatever I can control. That helps you to feel not so like helpless or hopeless. Like, I can make sure like I have a clean, happy, good environment to live in each day. I have, you know, cats that I have some control over with an asterisk. and I have control over how I respond to situations. I think all too often we kind of give in and be like, oh man, like hands up, I'm out. Like I can't do anything about this. And it's like, no, actually you can. You don't have to fight back with someone. You can choose not to. And then you can choose to kind of listen to how you're feeling, give yourself some time. I think the biggest thing with emotions and with cravings and urges is that time is an important factor here. If you mm-hmm. are able to ride that wave and get through it, your body will eventually kind of release because we can't be so heightened at this level of arousal for a long period of time. Our central nervous system just can't sustain it. It's exhausting for our bodies. And so that's why a lot of these like mindfulness or control based kinds of things that you can engage in just gives yourself enough time to get through it. And then it's a whole lot better at a later point in time. We all too often like give into our emotions and like someone made me mad. No, I made myself mad. Here's why I made myself mad. What can I go do now going forward? And it's the same thing with substance use, is that you've got to ride that wave. Those cravings and urges are going to happen. Even people who have been sober for 10, 20, 30 years, they still have them every now and again when they're experiencing maybe a difficult loss or some trauma or some stuff that's going on in their life. But if they're able to get through the intensity in the beginning, then they're more likely to be successful in the long run.
I think that's great. For me personally, that was a really huge mindfuck for me. You are not your emotions. You are not the thoughts in your head. You're the one that thinks them. because I, my whole life, I've been insanely angry, and everyone else, it's their fault. They've pissed me off. My parents didn't know how to take care of me. What the fuck? It's their fault. Like, it's been a ride. And I think the biggest advice is just, you're choosing to show up and be with yourself, and this awareness expands, and you can set an intention for who you want to be and hold that vision and ride the wave with that. It keeps you afloat. It's keeping me afloat.
Totally. And I think, like, a lot of people think, oh, well, I'm a victim of circumstance. You know, I'm a product of my environment. Sure, you might be if you're choosing to be that way.
Well, we are to some extent, and then we have the opportunity to learn that and change it.
Yes.
Of course. Okay. Always. Yes, you are a victim of circumstances, certain categories and certain levels. But overall, at the end of the day, it's life is 10% the things that happen to you and 90% the way you respond. Because just what you're experiencing in life is like just the very tip of the iceberg. And what you decide to do with those situations and with those feelings and with those intense, like whether it's a trigger or whether it's, you know, an intense craving, or, you know, maybe you're, you know, having to relive something that you don't want to relive. You know, I align with you, Courtney. I went through a lot of stuff in my early, you know, childhood and adulthood of, you know, really messed up situations I didn't want anything to do with. And it really pushed me into a place, especially in my teen years, you know, which is already a hot mess, into being a very angry person. And becoming a young adult and where I am now is recognizing that I'm choosing at this point, when I get angry, to lose control. When in reality, I know that I have the ability to pump the brakes. I can take stock of how I'm feeling. And if I choose not to do that, I'm responsible for my reaction.
I like to think of it as like a volume dial. Like, you can either turn the volume up and give into it, or you can turn it down and engage in some good coping skills and get yourself through that moment. That's what I was thinking about when you were mentioning this, is that volume dial idea.
I like that.
And we're not perfect. Like, this is all about practice. You know, the more we practice something, the better we're going to get at it. You know, okay, I want to brush my teeth twice a day. I'm not going to get to that built habit unless I maintain consistency. And the more consistent you can be, the better off you're going to be in the long run, because you're going to build those healthy mechanisms. You're going to build those healthy coping skills and, you know, giving yourself the space to just be like, whew, what's happening? Oh my God. And just open yourself up to the vulnerability of experiencing those things. I think a lot of people probably listening to this podcast even will say like, okay, when I'm angry, I'm angry. When in reality, our anger, much like that therapeutic, you know, thing that Maddie was talking about, where we have our patients kind of like color in the little like empty gingerbread person, like, oh, where do I feel this emotion? If we can take stock of what we're feeling, we're way better, you know, adapted to our own experience. And we can take those things and say, okay, here's where I'm at. Here's what I'm experiencing. If I can recognize these things more often and challenge myself to sit in those emotions, I can ride the wave of the emotion, ride the wave of whatever intense craving I may have. Like, my instant go-to is I want to eat if I'm stressed, like I mentioned. And if I can just sit there and be like, I'm not actually hungry. My coping strategy that may not be the best thing for me at times is to occupy my mouth. I want to put something in there. I want to chew. I want to savor something, whatever it may be. I want that experience. And if I can see what is it that I'm missing right now, it may be grounding. It may be connection with other people. I think that's a really big driving force in a lot of ways for people when they're trying to fill that void. Especially right now in a pandemic, from what I'm experiencing and hearing from my colleagues and my peers and even my supervisors at the hospital I work at, substance use has gone way up because people are left in this kind of dire strait experience where, you know, they're like, I don't know what to do with this like vacant time. I need to fill that time with something and I don't feel good. I'm uncomfortable. And this thing brings me comfort. It gets me out of how I'm feeling. It allows me to escape. When in reality, if we can just okay, I want to escape right now. I'm feeling uncomfortable. I'm very upset. If we notice that we're going into an anger response or an escape response, what's actually sitting there? Am I sad? Am I fearful? Am I having some other experience that is more vulnerable to me than anger, which feels like I can control it better? Then you can actually process those things and say, oh, okay, this is where I'm at. This is how I'm feeling. And then, okay, how do I help myself? I'm upset. I'm scared. I'm fearful. I'm anxious. Okay, I'm going to go on a run, which is easier said than done, of course. But like, you know, give yourself the opportunity. Okay, I have this anxious feeling, or I have this fear, or whatever it may be, whatever that driving force underneath those, like, you know, we call them secondary emotions. Like, you know, happiness and anger are two very like secondary emotions. There's other stuff underneath that. And if we can uncover what's under there and sit with it and be like, okay, what do I have in my toolbox to help myself right now? If I process what I'm feeling and I'm like, okay, I want to eat, just kidding, I'm going to drink some water. I'm going to do some cross stitching. I'm going to get my hands in the earth. I'm going to go on a walk with my dog. Like, these things are much healthier coping mechanisms for me. Processing it with a friend, I'll call Maddie and just be like, hey, you want to chat? I'm stressed. Or do something fun that brings you joy. I think a lot of people think like, okay, you know, I'm going to engage in the substance. It's going to make me feel better. And it's a very temporary fix for a longer term problem.
I call it the Band-Aid, because it really is a Band-Aid solution. And a lot of it comes down to not wanting to feel what we're feeling from either our previous trauma or whatever is happening currently. We want to feel a different way, and we want to feel a different way now. People are not really good at sitting with feelings of fear, anger, uncomfortability, right. Sadness. And so it's immediately like, I just want a head change, is what my patients will say to me. I want a head change. I just don't want to feel, hello. Sorry, my cat wants to join. It's a Band-Aid solution ultimately. And substance use, it's very alienating. It's a very lonely kind of process to go through, because it's hard to maintain stable employment depending on how much you're using. It's hard to maintain good relationships with others if you're using. And then kind of compacting that with what's happening now in the pandemic, we're by ourselves a whole lot. It's even further alienating you. I think people are having a hard time just sitting here being like, I don't really have anywhere to go. I don't think we realized, it's kind of like secondary gratitude in a way. Like, I don't think we realized how important social connections were, and that this whole process has reminded us we are missing social connection. We are social beings, and being removed from social connections increases substance use. When you feel like you have no one else, why wouldn't you continue using? It feels terrible to be lonely.
Yeah. I want to, oh my gosh, so many things. Thank you. I can say that every time you share, but I just want to reiterate that it takes time, like years and years, which is why I say that having a self-care lifestyle is a lifelong commitment of showing up for yourself, because to have these tools and this awareness and to know, even to know and be able to speak to your emotions. I know specifically for men, that's extremely hard to actually be able to speak to their specific emotions. And I just want to circle back real quick to what you were saying, Paige, and how it's 90% of the way you respond, which I completely agree with. But I think we do also have to talk about that it's also where we learned that in our childhood. It's a nervous system response. And so hearing you say like, okay, I feel myself getting angry, I know now I'm choosing to get angry, I would still say like, I don't fucking choose to get angry. But I'm finally at a place in my life where I can recognize what that anger is, instead of it just vomiting out of my mouth and turning into a beast.
Totally.
I think let me say this. Because language-wise, it's not either or, it's and. And life is very gray. It's not these distinct black and white categories.
Yes.
It's not like a chicken egg, who came first. It is the interpretation, which is what we're getting at. It's your interpretation of your experiences. Because all three of us could experience a lion walking into our apartments right now, and we would all have different reactions, wouldn't we? Someone might be like,
oh, yeah.
And then you might be like, oh my God, why is there a lion in here? I'm terrified. So it's about our interpretation, but it does also have to do with what we were modeled as children, how our parents responded to things. I don't like to be that person that's like, it really comes down to your parents, but like, it kind of really does, or whoever you grew up with, if you grew up in the foster system or you grew up with, you know, a caregiver of some sorts. So just wanted to preface that before Paige responded.
Totally. And actually I wanted to bring that up as well. I mean, as a student, I'm like, Maddie and I can both attest to this. Like, we are constantly changing our rhetoric and constantly relearning how to effectively speak about these things. I want to go back to what I had said originally, where it's like, I am choosing to get angry. That's not like a conscious thought.
Right.
And I definitely, like, I recognize it after the fact, of course. Like, I get pissed and I'm gone. Right. Which is something that yeah. And, you know, I recognize for myself that in those moments after the fact, I chose to allow myself to go that far. And that's a personal thing.
Right.
I recognize from my own experience why I get that angry now and why it's not something that I am okay with, and I'm actively working on it. And even in those kinds of things, like, that's not necessarily in a, you know, talking about addiction or substance use or anything like that. But like, these things that we learn and these things that we, you know, do over and over and over again become these habits. And when we recognize, oh, maybe this isn't the habit I want to have anymore, we put ourselves in the position to recognize, oh, well, I ultimately can change this if I want to. And I think it's really important to go against these taboos. I think a lot of old school people in the therapy world and in the self-care world might think like, oh, we don't talk about substance use. We don't talk about suicide. We don't talk about these heavy things because it's going to make that person think of doing those things. That's not the case these days. The more we can have these conversations and the more we can shed light on just the human experience and how we're feeling and take away the idea that these things are taboo, the easier it becomes to talk about it, the easier it becomes to seek help and to help ourselves ultimately. You know, something that I recently learned, this is the beauty of being in school still, is that I get to go to all these cool like training experiences. And I did one recently on Gestalt therapy. And there was one thing that came out of it that really just kicked it for me. And I was just like, yes, I'm about this. For those who don't know what Gestalt is, a very, very small preface of what Gestalt is it's a behavioral technique in which a therapist calls out their patient or their client and calls attention to a behavioral pattern, or calls attention in a gentle kind of way, not traditionally. Now these days, it's more just like, hey, I noticed this thing for you. If you have a chance to go to Gestalt therapy at any point, like, test it out. It's interesting. And I would say that I myself, like within cognitive behavioral therapy, I would find myself doing a lot of Gestalt therapy things myself for my patients, which is like picking up on their patterns, picking up on what's going on with them. And if we can do that for ourselves, we're in a good spot. And I notice my patterns now. I get anxious. I get upset. I want to eat. Something ticks me off. I get angry because I'm hungry, but really I'm just freaked out and sad. And so if I can pick up on those behaviors and pick up on those patterns, I can kind of be like, oh, there's the break in the chain. Let me kick that and stop it. And let's try something different.
Yeah.
And I think that, so what I was getting to is this phrase that came out of it is in Gestalt therapy, it's uncomfortable to recognize where we are and to be that vulnerable. And the moment we allow ourselves to step out of our discomfort with being uncomfortable, as weird as that sounds, it's kind of like a double thing. If I can move past my discomfort with being uncomfortable and accept where I'm at right now, I put myself in a place of, okay, I recognize this is where I am. This is who I am. This is what I'm experiencing. And it gives me the basis to recognize my own knowledge of where I'm at and be able to say, this is what I don't like. This is what I want to change.
Oh my
this
gosh.
Is what I have control over.
Yes, 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 yes.
I love it.
And I want to circle back to what you were saying about this idea that you can be dealt a really crap hand of cards in your life. And to this idea of privilege, that some of us have experienced different levels of trauma than other folks. There's definitely people that experience worse than myself. And the important part is that we walk our path by ourselves. Like someone else's trauma does not have an impact on my trauma. I still experience my trauma
yes.
through my life. And we learn our patterns. We're modeled these, whether it's from our parents or someone else. And to kind of pull it back into substance use, it's really uncomfortable to have to unlearn something you've been doing for 20, 30, 40 years of your life. It's terrible. Say that again. It's terrible to try and make some change. And it all starts with like introspection and mindfulness and knowing that like, okay, I don't want to keep doing this. And that's why sometimes you need some help. It's really hard to do it on your own without the tools and the knowledge that you may need from a professional. And that's okay that you need that help. But that's why this process is so difficult, is because you have to unlearn something you've been doing for so long. The comfortable thing is to continue doing what you're doing. It's the path of least resistance.
Yes.
Easiest path. Change is incredibly hard. And wanting to make a difference is incredibly hard. I have really bad anxiety, and I have to stop myself and say, okay, is this the end of the world? Like, am I going to be okay? And even having to stop myself in the moment is probably one of the hardest things I have to do. And I educate my patients on this as well. It's the hardest thing you're going to have to do to stop yourself in the moment and try to have a conversation with yourself, determine what's going on, what I'm feeling, and where would I like to go to next. It's hard to do that. But once you start getting in the habit of doing that, it becomes your new normal. What is it, the phrase that we learned from Dr. Camlin, that recovery and sobriety is when like your lifestyle is the change. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to do anything. It becomes who you are now. And that's how we know when someone is successful in living a sober lifestyle, is because it's not an active thing that they have to do anymore. It's just who they are now. But it takes a long time to get to that point.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh,
I mean, people are going to have totally different like experiences when it comes to recovery. Like what is recovery to me is not going to be the same recovery to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And it all comes down to what you want. How do you want to feel? How do you want to be? What do you want to do in your life?
Yeah.
And you know, if you are struggling with something, you know, that you may or may not be necessarily addicted to, or just like have a compulsion for, you know, it's like Maddie said, it's very easy to fall back into perpetual behavioral patterns. You know, we like to feel comfortable. We are creatures of comfort.
That's like a nervous system.
Totally.
It's not this decision. Like, I'm comfortable.
We like our consistency. We like our routines. We like our schedules. We don't like new as much as we try to say that we do.
Yeah.
And I think something from like ACT therapy, which is acceptance and commitment therapy, the question that I always, with anything, ask my patients is what I'm doing right now aligning with my long-term goal? What is my long-term goal? If my long-term goal is sobriety, is what I'm doing right now going to help me with that or not? It's a simple question you can ask yourself. You might have a battle with yourself, but you need to ask that question to be like, that's how you start to modify your behavior, is just asking yourself these questions, is like, is this what I want to do long-term, if I'm thinking 5 years from now? And so that's a good question to ask yourself for a lot of different things that you do. Is me spending money on this thing right now going to help me with my long-term goal? Maybe I'm trying to save for something. No. Okay. So maybe I need to change a little bit, tinker here and there.
That's such a great analogy, and really bringing it back to how, like, making it realistic. I really appreciate that. Mm-hmm. We are coming up on the end of our hour. I feel like I could seriously just want to talk to you guys all day long. I'm like, more. There's so many things that I want to go back to. But one thing that I'd really like to speak to in our last minutes here is, if you don't mind, is sharing more of your own individual stories. Paige, I know you touched on yours a little, but I know that, you know, we don't walk these paths because we had perfect childhoods.
Totally. Oh my God. I mean, I come from a background of, like, for me, the hard knocks. Like, I was the parent in my family for a very long time. We call that parentification these days. And once I recognized that within myself, like, the hardest thing to do is stop the thing you're comfortable doing. And I'm going to bring it back to, you know, substance use and addiction is, you know, when we get comfortable doing something, it's really hard to pull away. And when you are the person who's seen as in control, it's really hard to abdicate that control to someone else and force them to be the parent. So I came from a background of, you know, like having a family that had their own substance use issues. You know, my parents both struggled with that for a while. My sister also, she's younger than me, and she's also struggled with that previously. And for me, it was like so important to figure out, why am I this person? Why am I the person that wants to help? And that pushed me towards wanting to, you know, go into therapy and be a therapist, because I recognize these challenges as these challenges for people within myself. And I super love and adore working with kids and teenagers, just because I think it if you can start at a younger age recognizing what's challenging for you, especially during identity development, it's phenomenal what kids can do. They're way smarter than we give them credit for. We were all children once. Yeah. And I love working with kids. Last year I got to work with kids in juvenile hall, and they are some of the best kids I've ever worked with. And if any of them are listening to this podcast, hey, but no, I think it's so important to, you know, for me and my experience, I want to help people. I want to help them see the light at the end of the tunnel that I was able to see in myself. And that they have control, and at least in, you know, 10% of their life, they have control, you know, even if it feels like the whole world is, you know, falling down around you. And so for me, that's what I love to do. I'm actually doing a dissertation on loss, and its impact on, you know, life in general. I'm looking at substance use and adverse childhood experiences, resiliency, mental health. Like it's a pretty big study. And so once I get that, me too. My God, I cannot wait to get started on, you know, collecting data, because I think it's so important to recognize, like, what are our resources? Loss is such a common thing, you know, and especially right now.
Sorry, I'm just going to interrupt you real quick while we're on that topic. You and I have talked about your research, and I really do plan on including this self-care community as well to be able to contribute to that. So if you're interested in that, definitely make sure that you say.
Oh, I would love that.
Yeah.
I would love that. Yeah. Anyone and everyone who's interested in this, once I get approval, I will be, you know, providing a link. It'll all be online and anonymous. It's really important research that I'm hoping to share on a larger level. Because I think, you know, especially for, you know, teens and kids, like younger kids who are in, you know, environments where they're not getting the best support, or they're not, you know, in a place where they can access resources for themselves, you know, getting schools involved, getting after school programs involved in recognizing, you know, different things are going on with children, and getting them those resources, advocating for them, making sure that they have supports when they don't necessarily have them at home. Getting parents involved, you know, especially in making sure that those families have what they need to be successful, especially.
I'm literally tearing up over here.
And I was going to say, and that's where my study comes.
I mean, just to, you know, end what I was talking about is just, you know, I will be sharing that with people. If people want to get involved, I would love to hear from people. The more the merrier for this study, obviously. The more people I can get involved, the better. Because it's so important to be able to create lasting change. And if I can just get people to recognize, at least here in the States, like, we need to look after our kids. We have to be able to provide these resources, you know, especially in lower socioeconomic areas. We need to, you know, vamp it up a little bit. Let's get them these resources. Let's create these programs.
Yes.
So that way kids that are designated as high risk, like, let's get people out of that category. Let's try to, like, reduce the amount of people that are in that, you know, school to jail pipeline. That's such a horrible situation. Like, kids should not be placed in that realm and have to, like, go through those traumatic experiences and end up in a place where they don't have control over themselves. They're stuck in a system. Like, let's get them out of the situation. Let's get them the help they need, the support they need, so that way they can be successful.
Yeah.
Like, my God, it's not that hard. So yeah, so my research is important.
Oh, I was just going to say, when you have that link, I will definitely be sharing it with our community.
Oh, yes.
And yeah, we'll talk more, but I definitely want to work with you.
Totally.
Out for sure. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, I guess it's me now.
Drum roll for Maddie.
I need a written invitation to start now. No, I'm kidding. You know, Paige and I's research is somewhat similar. I'm looking at the impact of social support on criminal deviance within sexual and gender minorities, because I see that this idea of social support, and it doesn't necessarily mean your family. It means your friends. It means your community. It means your teachers. It means your government providing adequate support. People are less likely to get incarcerated. We're seeing sexual and gender minorities incarcerated at quite an alarming rate. And it's because these different groups of people are not having adequate resources. And that's why we're seeing people in the system. And then they're there for such a long time. It's truly a sad experience seeing people spend years and years and years incarcerated. My goal is to get people out of prison as much as possible. My background is, I have my mom, and she's very mentally ill, has been for most of my life. Paige can attest to this. Yes. And it's been very difficult. I was also parentified. My parents separated when I was young. I had to raise my brother, and my mom asked me for parenting advice, and I don't have children of my own. And so these boundaries are very much blurred, and I have substance use on both sides of my family. A lot of illicit drugs as well as alcohol. I made a decision to stop drinking about 2 years ago. Not that I ever had a problem with alcohol. Frankly, I couldn't really stand alcohol a whole lot. I have such a high tolerance. It was just not a fun experience for me, but I just made a decision to like not include that in my lifestyle, because I know I have these risk factors, and I don't think I would have ever thought I would have worked in substance use. I remember the first day I ran a substance use group, and I may have told Paige this, but I was just like, I can't do this. I don't know what I'm doing. And then I realized all of us, every single person has been touched by substance use. I don't think anyone can say they don't know someone that has gone through this experience. And I finally had a conversation with my brother-in-law. He was an alcoholic for a number of years. He's been sober now for, I think, 8 years. So happy birthday to my brother-in-law. And I've never talked with one of my family members like that before. Just being like, tell me what your experience is like and what worked for you. What helped? How could I help someone who's never been through this experience myself? And having these open, frank conversations have helped me to be where I am today and working with substance use and having no problem talking to people about these kinds of issues. I think I've grown in such a short period of time, and that I want to help educate the general public who has this idea that it's AA or no way, and that there are other ways of being able to navigate through your life. I think the tools of smart recovery can also help with everything else in your life. Like understanding like what my thoughts are, what my emotions are, how it leads to my behavior. And you can analyze yourself. No one else is going to do this for you. You can have someone help you through the process, but you just have to make a decision for yourself that I want to make a change. So I need to be really mindful of my own behavior. And that is the curse and also a good thing about being a therapist. We know where our problems are. You know, we're
very aware
from where some of my fears come from. It's my mom for the most part. And it's terrible knowing that, but there's also a peace in knowing that and being able to kind of go forward from there. So I don't believe like if I hadn't experienced these things as a child that I would not be where I am today. I would not be the person that I am today. So that volume dial, I turned it down and I decided I wanted to do something differently and to make a difference. And even if I can help just one person, I think I would be happy with that and be okay. I know I can't help everyone, but if I can just one thing for one person, they really learn something and they can make a difference in their lives, then I feel like I've done a good job. And my work is very hard. And Paige, I know her work is very hard, but it's very rewarding too. Because we do see some pretty good change in folks. And I talk a lot with substance use with people who are not my patients, who are friends. It's very hard to maintain that good professional line between I'm not your therapist, I'm your friend.
Right.
But we can take the time to help educate our friends and give them some feedback and more of the advice, which is not something that we do as psychologists. We don't give people advice, but you know, that's the more friendly version of trying to help people out. So I'm really happy to be a part of this. Thank you so much for inviting me.
You're so welcome. You know, I heard Paige mention, I think you said, why am I the one that's interested in this? Was that the question you found came to you? And I also had a little moment in my childhood where I specifically in my mother, I remember her faking her happiness to me all the time. And I remember being like, I'm not going to be that. Like, I want to be like, what is true happiness? And then holy shit, I had no idea this is like, that was like an unconscious path on my life all of a sudden now. And I'm just curious, Maddie, do you think you had a moment at all like that, like with your childhood or like just like this little tiny thing that kind of like is an intention you've held for this path? Or it's okay if not, I just wanted to ask.
I think there was a time when I was 18, I got in a bad fight with my mom and I didn't speak with her for a year. Mm. And I had some pretty frank conversations with my sister who shed one of the most enlightening things I've ever heard. And I tell her this all the time. And I said to her, I was like talking about mom, I'm having difficulties with her. I don't know how to help her. And that's where part of this came from, is feeling helpless. Like I can't help her. And I can't, she's my mom. I'm not, you know, going to help her in a therapist kind of way. She needs to seek out her own therapy. But my sister said to me, you know, Madison, once you realize that our parents are just people and they make mistakes and they don't know really any better than you do, life becomes a whole lot easier when you take people off these pedestals and that everyone has experienced difficulty. Everyone's, for the most part, I don't know any family that's truly functional. Yeah. Everyone has a dysfunctional family. Yeah. And you decide to make some changes for yourself. But I think without that background of having these frustrations with my mom, and like, I never knew what side of her I was going to get. She's bipolar. Some days it's great. And then other days it's like terrifying to be around her, that I felt like I couldn't share with other people. And I wanted people to feel comfortable sharing with me. And so I've kind of always been in this therapist role since I was really young. I think I just always wanted to like help other people and listen to other people, and people would come to me when they wanted to talk to me. And I've now made it a career, something that I really enjoy doing. Mm-hmm. And it was because of my background that led me here. It's also, you know, it's good and bad, you know?
Yeah.
I think that was probably some time that really struck me and resonated with me. And I was like, you know, everyone has like this difficult mom or aunt or grandparents or dad, and they need help too. And sometimes they just want someone to listen.
That's well, so funny. Funny little fact, I think Maddie will remember this. In our first class, in our first year of grad school, one of our professors was like, most of you here are in this field because you wanted to fix something or understand something in your own life, which is pretty much the standard. Like, most therapists have been through their own garbage. And right now, like, you know, this is such an important time to recognize, like, we as therapists, like, we also go through stuff. We also have anxiety and depression, and we show up for people despite those things. And we want to help people learn how to show up for themselves because we get it. We totally get it. And I wanted to emphasize, you know, just to wrap this up, therapy is not a one size fits all. There are so many different kinds of therapy and so many different ways of experiencing it. And I highly, highly recommend as a therapist to go therapist shopping. If you're in the market to find a therapist, like, you know, figure out what it is you want and look for a specialist. Don't look for somebody who does everything under the sun. Look for somebody who specifically does and works on what you want to work on. And like, interview them.
Would anxiety
ask them questions?
Anxiety, depression, substance use. You know, if you're looking for therapists, there's on Psychology Today is a great resource, but it'll be like a laundry list of what this person works on. When in reality, we specialize in something and we're really good at one thing and we're just okay at other things. I can do other kinds of therapy. I can do some DBT, some ACT. I'm not really a psychoanalyst, so I won't bother with that kind of stuff personally, but I could do it. It's just, you want to find someone who does what you're looking for. You want the best of the best. You just don't want some generic person that says that they work with this thing. Yeah. And we also understand that not everyone's going to be a good fit for us. Unfortunately, our patients don't really have a choice. They are assigned to us. Yeah. They have to work with us unless it's like very bad situation. So don't come looking for us specifically, but look for someone who, with stuff you really want to work on, someone that actually specializes in that, because it'll be so much more fruitful, I think, over time.
Yeah, and give yourself and your therapist the benefit of the doubt and find somebody who you can vibe with. Honestly, like, check your vibes, like, legitimately. Like, when you find a therapist and you talk to them, and if it doesn't mesh, walk away. Try someone else, because it's so important to find someone who you click with.
Yeah, I think I cut you off at the end on accident. You were saying interview them, and that could even just be, like, actually, calling can be intimidating, but if you do call, like, hearing the tone in someone's voice and, like, are they relatable? More and more people are coming down to this human level, and it's not so much this pedestal. It's like, I, at least when I'm looking for a therapist, I want to have somebody that I'm connecting with, that I feel heard, that knows how to talk to me and not just tell me what to do, because that's that doesn't resonate with me.
Yeah,
and I think it's important to know that first impressions usually happen within the first 10 seconds. Yeah. You will know very quickly, and you have to trust your gut. You will know quickly if you like with someone and you vibe with them well. And if you don't, like, no harm, no foul. It is okay to walk away. Granted, you know, over time you can learn more about this person, but it's really, really quick. So you got to just trust the process.
Yeah. And don't change
also
yourself. Like, it's okay. It's okay that if you're just like, ah, I'm going to just try someone else.
Yeah.
And honestly, like, as therapy students, like, I will always in the future just be like, hey, we may not fit together. Like, we can have a session and see if this works. And if you feel uncomfortable, I will refer you out. I will find somebody else and give you other options, because this is about you as the client, not me. If I don't work for you, that's okay. Like, it's not about me and, like, my ego and, like, oh, I'm the best. Like, I want the people that come seeking help to get the help they want and the help that they need. And as a secondary option for people through Psychology Today and the Provider Finder, you can actually email them first. And if they respond to you in a timely manner, you can call them. You can see how they respond via email. I think when it comes to our linguistics, the way that we read emails and texts have changed over time. So you can get a little bit of a vibe from someone based on how they email and how quickly they respond. But with that, I was wondering if the two of you would be open for our last couple of minutes to do a cool little progressive muscle relaxation technique together.
Yes, please.
Okay. So
quick. When we're taking, because Paige is going to like walk you through this, we want to make sure we're doing good diaphragmatic breathing. So when you're breathing through this exercise, you want to breathe in through your nose and you hold it. You make sure your diaphragm is expanding, and then you let out through your mouth. I've done biofeedback. That is the proper way to do good breathing, is in through the nose, hold it for a couple seconds, and then out through your mouth, and like really like get into it, because that's going to make this process a whole lot better.
I'm going to do a side note here for people that have a stuffy nose or something like that. If you can't hold, like, breathe in through your nose, that's okay. And yes, if for any reason you start to feel panic or are triggered by holding your breath at all, that is okay too. Just breathe. Like, we're just inviting you to be with us and breathe and make it work for your body.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely. And if you have the ability to, for those that are listening, get comfortable. You could be laying on the floor. You could be sitting in a chair. You could be laying on your couch with your animal on your chest. Like, whatever makes you happy and comfortable, do it. And so I take a little bit of a different approach with progressive muscle relaxation. I want everybody to be comfortable. So in the beginning, we're going to take a couple of deep breaths in through your nose and out through your mouth if you're able to. If not, you can breathe through your mouth. Totally fine. And as you're breathing in, just take a moment to feel. You can put your hands on your chest and on your stomach, and you want to feel a little bit of your chest rise and try to get your tummy to rise if you can. We call that belly breathing for children. Deep breathe in. Let the air fill your lungs. Let the air fill your diaphragm, and allow yourself to breathe out. Okay. As we breathe in, we're going to begin to slowly allow our body to feel the tension of becoming tight. And as we breathe out, allow ourselves to feel the tension leaving the body and the lungs. We're going to take another deep breath in together. Allow yourself to hold it just for a moment and breathe out. If you're comfortable allowing yourself to breathe and make the noise, sometimes that helps. As we breathe in with this next step, we're going to move our attention to our feet. If you feel your feet, if you're wearing socks, if you're wearing shoes, if you have your feet planted on the ground, notice how they feel. As you breathe in, take a deep breath, fill your lungs, and try to curl your toes or stretch those toesies out a little bit. Feel the tension in your toes as you continue to breathe. Hold that tension in your toes and feel what it feels like to have tension in your foot. And as you breathe out on your next breath, allow yourself to gently relax your feet. Allow yourself to feel the new sensation of relaxation. Take another deep breath in when you have a moment. Allow yourself to focus on your calves this time. You can tense these by pointing your toes forward or flexing your feet towards the sky. And allow yourself to feel the tension in your lower leg without going to the point of pain. Take a couple of deep breaths in. Allow yourself to hold that tension in your legs. And as you breathe out on your next breath, allow yourself to drop the tension. Relax your feet. Allow yourself to continue breathing. Take in a sense of how your legs are feeling. Do they still feel tight? If they do, allow yourself to shake it out a little bit. Now I want you to bring your attention to your lower legs and your thighs, as well as your gluteus. And what we're going to do is take another deep breath in. And if you're sitting or laying down, you can tense these areas by bringing your knees together and holding them as tight as you can together without going to the point of pain. As you hold this pose, allow yourself a moment to take a deep breath in. Hold that tension just for a moment. Feel the tenseness in your lower back, in your legs, in your thighs. And as you breathe out on this next breath, allow your thighs to relax. Relax your hips. Relax your knees. Feel the new sensation of relaxation in your lower legs and in your back. And continue taking breaths as you move forward. The next area we're going to focus on is our stomach and chest. As you're breathing in on this next pose, you're going to pull your belly button in towards your spine. And tense your abs. Pretend you're Superman if you want. And just hold that tightness. Become that rock. And continue breathing. Easier said than done. But I believe in you all. Take a deep breath in, hold that tension just a tiny bit longer. Now on this next breath, you're going to release, allow your belly to go limp again, allow your back to relax, allow your chest to feel full of air as you breathe. If you notice yourself still having some tightness in your stomach or in your chest, allow yourself to just move your shoulders and allow yourself to just kind of like move your body a little bit if you need to. And continue taking nice, slow, deep breaths. The next area we're going to do is the arms and the neck. What we're going to do is you can put your arms out to the sides. You can curl them in towards your chest and hold your hands and fists. And what you're going to do is you're going to bring your shoulders up towards your ears. You're going to put your hands and fists and ball them up. You can do this by straightening your arms or curling them in towards the chest. And you're just going to hold a deep breath and hold that tightness just for a moment. And as you hold that tension, notice if you're going too far. If you're feeling pain, try to relax it a little bit. Hold the tension and allow yourself on this next breath out. Drop your arms, open up your fingers, shake out your arms. Feel the new sensation of your muscles in your chest relaxing, the muscles in your neck relaxing. Feel the new sensation of things being loose. The last one is my favorite. It's the best one to do with people in person. since we're all on a podcast, you don't have to have anybody around you, which is beautiful. On your next deep breath in, I want you to make the sourest face you can. Tighten every beautiful muscle in that gorgeous face of yours. Make just the sourest face. Take a nice deep breath in. Pucker your lips. Make your eyes really tight. You can flare your nostrils if you'd like to. Just hold that tension in your face. If you notice your tongue on the top of your mouth, that's also a way to tense your jaw. And then on your breath out, relax everything. Allow yourself to just drop. You can open your mouth and do some mouth aerobics and make different O face things. You can smile. You can just go, ah, really big. And allow your whole face, your eyebrows, your nose, your mouth, your lips, your jaw to just relax. As a last and final step, we're going to go all the way through the body. We're going to take a nice deep breath in. And I want you to curl your toes, pull your knees in, suck that belly in there, make it as tight as you can, become that rock, almost go into a very tight fetal position and make that sour, sour face. And as you breathe in, hold that tension. And then as you breathe out, shake it out, allow your body to go limp. Feel the difference between the previous tension and the new sensation of relaxation. And I hope everyone enjoyed. Welcome to the beauty of progressive muscle relaxation.
Wow, I didn't
know. How's everybody feeling?
Amazing.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we forget how we're feeling. This is a really good way to check in with your body, especially if you notice you're going into a place of, you know, feeling cravings and urges, if you're noticing you can't sleep, if you're noticing that you're stressed out. I do this every once in a while right before I go to bed or even after a really tough session with a patient. You can do this at work, at your desk. You can do it in your car. There's a lot of really beautiful things that you can do with progressive muscle relaxation. You don't always have to close your eyes. You can do it while you're walking around the store. So this is a beautiful tool. I wanted to share this with the community so that people have just an extra resource, something that they can do on their own, especially during these COVID times. And I hope people enjoyed. If anybody wants to actually look at progressive muscle relaxation, there's a lot of really cool YouTube links that guide you through this as well. And if you just feel like looking at the script yourself, you can go on Therapist Aid. And it's in the worksheets for anxiety and emotions. And this is just a really cool one, progressive muscle relaxation.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Can you please tell everybody where they can find each of you if you feel comfortable sharing, if they want to follow you on Instagram or get in touch with your work at all?
Yeah. My Instagram is Pais Fache, which is French, and I'm sure I'm butchering it, but it's P-A-I-S. F as in Frank, A-C-H-E-R. I just post, it's my personal Instagram. I sometimes will post resources for therapy and things like that on there. So if people want to follow me, by all means, feel free to. I am always happy to connect people with resources. And, you know, life is too short. Just have fun, you know.
Thank you, Paige.
Yeah, you can also follow me. I post a lot of my cats. So if you like cats, and you should definitely come see them. They're hilarious. But also sometimes I follow a lot of like therapist meme pages. And so I just laugh about my job sometimes because it's really stressful. you can follow me at Maddie Reed. So it's M-A-D, three I's, I-I-I, and then Reed, R-E-E-D. And that is my personal Instagram. And I have no problem with people following me. I'd love to chat. I have people that message me all the time asking questions about my job or, you know, resources or just like thoughts and opinions on things. I like communicating with other people. Sometimes I get on there and I post some, we both do it, long videos about things that are going on currently and just how we're dealing. And so, yeah, it's a fun time over there.
Yeah. And just as a reminder to the community, like all of you guys are beautiful people. We love being a part of this. And just as a reminder, we are not licensed clinicians yet. We're working towards it. So we can't be your therapist yet. But, you know, if you're ever stuck and you want resources or just want to, you know, figure out what it is you need, like, feel free to shoot us a message. We'd be happy to, you know, try to sort that out with you and point you in the right direction if we can.
Yeah.
Oh, that's such a huge offer. And I'm like, wow, please take them up on this offer. This is huge. This is such, like, what an invaluable resource. And I can't thank you. I sincerely cannot thank you both for taking this time to be here and to have this conversation. And I know it's going to help just so many people. And it's helping me in more ways than I can comprehend in this moment. So thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for having us. This was such a great honor to talk about things that we're really passionate about, that we study a whole lot. We're not like the leading professionals, but, you know, we're some really sarcastic, down to earth people. And we really try to use genuineness in our practice and how we engage with other people. So we are open books and we are willing to chat with anyone.
Yeah. Thank you for having us. This was lovely. And again, if anybody is going through it right now, we feel you, we understand where you're at, and you know, give yourself a break. If there's anything that we can share with the whole community, give yourself a beautiful, beautiful break, you lovely people, because you're probably holding yourself to a ridiculously high standard during these crazy times.
Get that self-care.
Yeah. Yes, self-care.
As we all grab our water and take a sip.
Cheers. Cheers to you lovely people. Thanks for having us on. This was so awesome.
Thank you so very much for taking the time to tune into our conversation today. I hope that you're feeling empowered, fired up, inspired, and if you're really feeling like you want to dive a little deeper, don't forget I have plenty of free resources available to you on my website, as well as a handful now of online courses, including an online movement space that will be coming again, reopening this fall 2020. You can also sign up to have your own little candid conversation with me if you so desire, not recorded and in fact completely confidential. I offer self-care consults on a sliding scale, so you can feel free to check that out if you'd like some personalized, judgment-free lifestyle and stress management advice. Thank you for being here. Thank you for supporting me. And most of all, really, thank you so much for taking care of yourself. Yeah, let that sink in for a minute. Thank you for taking care of yourself. The world needs more people doing just that. Cheers to a conscious way of living, y'all, for ourselves, for our communities, and our planet. Until next time.